All right, welcome to class today. As a reminder, this was the math review. So that's all we're going to do. We're not going to talk about graphics today. If you had forgotten that and went to walk out, that's fine. Doesn't bother me at all. I recognize that some of you are probably here because there's some bone in your body that won't let you miss a class. Congrats, right? But we're still going to just go through some math. Part of the reason we do this is that actually, as currently designed, not all of our majors have to take any math at all. So depending on exactly how you navigated, it's possible you got here not having math since, like, I don't know, junior year of high school. And so we're going to review a few things, maybe teach a few things if you haven't seen some calculus before. So our basic topics are vectors, matrices, linear systems of equations, derivatives, just a little bit of that. We don't need a lot. And spherical integrals. We'll also talk about other kinds of integrals. These are the things that I think we will need at some point. Some of these we sort of need a little bit already, but we'll dive in a little bit. And there's always a challenge with this one, because the few of you that are here because you need it, I feel embarrassed about the many of you that are here that don't. And so I never get good questions in this one, even though I know some of you don't know. So anyway, I'm going to assume that you need this information. And if you want to ask clarifying questions, please do. And if you want to try to pretend like you don't know the material and ask a clarifying question somebody else might want to know the answer to, they may be happy you did. And so we will dive forward. All right. Are there any mathematical topics that we've mentioned in passing or you think might come up that are not on this list that you want to know something about? All right, I'll assume we all know how to multiply, etc. Okay, let's talk about vectors. Vectors can be described in lots of different ways. We can think of vectors as a list of real numbers. Okay. We can think of vectors as a representation of a Cayley construction of a sort of a of super complex numbers, which you probably none of you have seen. Any of you know what Cayley constructions are? No, I didn't think so. That's great. Sorry? Cayley, the graph theorist. Cayley, yeah. Anyway, great. We won't need this. If this is a quantum physics class, we would need this. Anyway, I just want to mention they're used in lots and lots of things. We sometimes think about them as direction and magnitude. And this is often the definition that's given in physics classes for vectors. Lots of uses for vectors. Usually in computer graphics, we think of them in this first context of a list of real numbers and have specific operations that work on them. Okay, so this is usually the definition we care about. There are multiple ways of writing them, just like there's multiple ways of using them. So often we write this list of real numbers sort of like, I don't know, a tuple in some languages and in theory and so on, parentheses and commas, right? So I might have 3, negative 2, 1 half, 8, right? This would be an example way of writing a vector. There are other ways of writing this same vector. Sometimes I will write it as what we sometimes call a column vector. So I might write it like this. This is the same vector, assuming I wrote the numbers correctly, yes. There is no difference between these when we're talking about them as vectors. Come back to matrices, we will see there is a difference. We will rarely, but sometimes, write them with square brackets, no commas, and big spaces. Okay, this is also the same thing. When we need to distinguish between these, we call this one a row vector, we call this one a column vector, and this one is just a vector. They're all vectors, but sometimes you write them in rows or columns. So, you have these lists of numbers. There's various things we do with these lists of numbers. So first we have the element-wise operations. Okay? There are basically three of these we care about. And you could argue two of them are the same. All right, so if I have x, y, z plus a, b, c, that means x plus a
y plus b, z plus c.
Hey, that is the definition. We have add, we also subtract. If we did subtraction instead, we would do it the similar way. Okay? Element-wise across. Okay? So these are the very common operations to do on vectors, add and subtract them. We just do it to the elements. We also have multiplication, which is sometimes called scaling. Okay? So this might be called scaling, it might not be called scaling, but this applies, it's a single real number that gets done here times a vector, and that just multiplies through. Okay? For various reasons, usually when we're dealing with vectors, we write multiplication as adjacency as opposed to with a multiplication operator, because we'll redefine all of the multiplication operators for vectors. So this is what these things mean. And they show up a fair amount. I'm assuming you've mostly seen this at least in passing before. I think vectors are commonly mentioned in enough other classes, you've probably seen this level before. You may have also, probably have also, seen the vector-vector operations. There are two that get talked about a lot, the dot and the cross product. Okay? The dot product is also known as the inner product. There is something called an outer product, but we almost never use it. And it is not the cross product. So what the dot product or inner product, if I say x, y, z dot a, b, c, what this means is I do an element-wise multiplication and then add the components together. So this is x a plus y b plus z c. And therefore, I have vector, and vector, and real number. Okay. Dot products have various geometric value as well. We'll talk about in just a moment, and we'll compare them to cross products. But we can describe these in terms of directions and magnitudes, as well as their other purposes. So we have a dot product. The cross product is special, and it is only defined for vectors of three elements. We can sort of make a pseudo cross product with vectors of two elements by cheating. If you have vectors of four elements, your cross product requires three vectors, and we never use it. So mostly it's just a, so this works for any length vector, but this works for three vectors. Okay, and this also results in a scalar, but not in an immediately obvious way. We could teach you the rule about how to figure it out, but it's really not worth memorizing. If you need to figure out how you do a cross product, look it up. If you happen to know it, great, right? This happens to be yc minus, let me sure I can get this right. It's yc minus bz minus xc plus za plus, right, anyway, there is this definition. I probably am getting it wrong because I'm trying to do it on the fly. I think that's its definition, just so that we don't confuse ourselves looking at this. Probably. Look up. Okay, I think this is its definition. Anyway, it's a set of multiplications, some added, some subtract. And it also gives you just a num. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm doing an inner product of it. Yes. No, I'm thinking about the 2 version and the 3 version at the same time. Silly me. Okay, that's better. Sorry, this is a 3 vector, okay? So this goes from vector and vector to vector. I almost made a really serious bloomer. Okay. I might have the exact components here wrong, but I think I have them right. And these two are primarily useful because of their geometric meaning, okay? So I mentioned that we think about vectors, we can think about them either as a list of real numbers, which we've done so far, but we can also think about them as a direction and magnitude. Okay? And so in the direction and magnitude space, we can draw them. We typically draw them as having an origin directed in magnitude, even though technically they don't have an origin, just a direction in magnitude. Okay? So if I have a couple of vectors, and let's suppose I call this, I don't know, let's call that the x vector and the y vector, then x dot y is defined to be the length of x times the length of y times the cosine of the angle between them. Okay, and this is just the definition of how this works. What is the length defined to be? This is the Euclidean distance length you've learned all the way along. Okay, so length, more explicitly, the length of a vector is defined to be the square root of the vector dotted with itself. This is a definition of Euclidean length. This is also called the L2 norm, but we won't need to go into other norms, so great, we'll just pretend this is all there is. Okay? And so this is convenient because using only multiplication and addition, I can find the cosine of something. Cosines are not easy to compute. They're transcendental functions. We don't have nice closed form solutions of computing a cosine exactly. So we often use dot products because we care about cosines. And we'll see cases we care about cosines in the coming days as we talk about illumination and other purposes that use cosines. So dot products are frequently used for that purpose. They typically assume, though, that we know the lengths of the vectors, and that requires a square root. Square roots are also a little awkward to compute, but not quite as bad as cosines. And we often need the square root for other reasons as well, anyway. The cross product of two vectors can also be defined in terms of their length and something, but it has a direction. Okay? So the length of the cross product is the length of the two vectors times the sine of the angle, the other trig function. That's its length, but it also has a direction. Okay? So the direction of x cross y is it's always perpendicular to both x and y. Okay? And then there are two such directions, and we have to pick between them. We're going to use the right-hand rule. All right. Just as a reminder, if we think about the cosine, just remind ourselves what sine and cosine look like. So if I have, this is my angle from 0 up to circle, which could be 2 pi or 360, depending on which way you like to think. Okay, the cosine is high here, low here, and back to high there. Okay. And so it oscillates like this-ish. I didn't make it quite as low below as this. But in particular, if x and y line up, this is big. So the dot product gets big if they point the same direction. Okay, if that distance angle between them is 0, it's maximal. Where is it minimal? Where is the dot product its most negative value? If they're pointing opposite directions, where is it 0? If they're perpendicular, 90 degrees apart. Okay? So we have this behavior. We also have the sine, which is just the same thing as a cosine, but offset by 90 degrees, right? Okay, so we have, I didn't quite do that right. All right. So the sine here, the sine is maximal if they're perpendicular. So this is big if they're perpendicular. And as they line up perfectly or completely opposite a line, it shrinks down to size 0. This is important because this needs to be perpendicular to both of them. And if they line up perfectly, there isn't just one perpendicular. So it'll shrink down to size 0 as they line up. And if they don't line up perfectly, then there is a perpendicular direction to them, and that is the direction the cross product points in. What do I mean by the right-hand rule? I have tried lots of ways of looking at this, but let's just look for right-hand rule. I think the picture on Wikipedia, if memory serves, is decent. Here is the right-hand rule. Okay, there are other versions of it. You have to use your right hand, hence the right-hand rule. Okay, you use your index finger and middle finger to be A and B, and you sort of, because you're folding up your other fingers, you half fold the middle finger, right? And the cross product of those points in the direction of your thumb. There are lots of other ways of describing this orientation. And I believe there's some other pictures in here, if my memory serves. You can think about it as axes. You can think about it by curling. You can think about it by springs, right? They have lots of different ways of doing it. If you know one, great. If you don't know one, this is what it means. So this actually shows up quite a lot in 3D. We very often care about right-hand versus left-handed coordinate systems, and right-hand versus left-hand comes up quite a bit in things we do in graphics. Some of you, this is second nature because you've thought about it a lot. Some of you will continue to hold up your hands and hope nobody notices all semester long and maybe for the rest of your life. That's fine. You only need it occasionally. There's no shame in using your fingers. All right. So, the right-hand rule, cross products. Questions about dot products, cross products, addition or scaling of vectors. Okay, one other thing I need to mention about vectors. I mentioned this idea of scaling. There are two particular scalings that we talk about a lot in graphics. One that shows up in other contexts in math as well, one that is sort of unique-ish to graphics. Okay? And so sometimes we will talk about normalizing. Okay? So normalizing typically means divide by the magnitude of your vector. Okay? So you divide by its length or magnitude. That is normalizing the vector. It forces its length or magnitude to be 1 after the fact. Okay? So we often will talk about this. We will occasionally refer to normalizing in a particular axis. And this you've actually already done for DDA. Okay? If I divide by x, if s is 1 over x, then I've normalized in x. If s is 1 over y, I've normalized in y, and so on. That use of normalizing in an axis is unusual outside of graphics. And we won't see it a lot in future graphics as much as we've seen it so far. But normalizing a vector is very common. A little bit about annoying vocabulary. Normal. Normal is defined as perpendicular. Normal is defined as length 1. These two have absolutely nothing to do with each other. But they both talk about vectors, and the word for both of them is normal. Also, normal is a pretty normal word. And so sometimes we use it to mean not special, just to be confusing. Okay, there is another name for this one, which is unit. So we sometimes talk about a unit vector. A unit vector is normal because it has length 1. We will also sometimes talk about a unit normal vector, by which we mean a length 1 vector that is perpendicular to something. Okay? We will come back and talk some more about these terms when they will matter as we're going along, but I just want to preview terminology is bad. And oh well. Yes?
How do you denote a unit vector?
The unit is only used in one of the two definitions. So there's only one kind of unit. So unit vector is just a unit vector. Unit is idempotent, if I've remembered the correct meaning of that word. Any other questions about vectors? All right, matrices. First off, this is actually a random aside. A matrix could have matrices, or matrixes, or matrices. There are three plurals. The S without the E is less common these days, so it's usually either matrices or matrixes. This also applies to vertex and other words we use that end in an X. We have multiple plurals. And some people are adamant about one or the other. I was taught my linear algebra by somebody that believed in the ICES version, and so I will typically default to that, but you're welcome to use the XES if you would prefer. Anyway, all right, so a matrix. A matrix also has multiple definitions. We're just going to talk about two of them. It's a grid of numbers, and it's a movie from the 1990s. No, and the other one is it's a linear operator. Okay, we'll talk more about the grid of numbers than the linear operator. There are many, many, many things we do with matrices. There's basically just two we need to know for this class, and one is the main part of it. Okay. We have a grid of numbers. We traditionally draw the grid of numbers with square brackets and the numbers in a grid. So we could write 1, 3, 2.1, negative 5, 0, 0, 8, negative 8, 10. Okay? This would be an example of a matrix. By far, the most common things we do with matrices are multiply them. And technically, there are different kinds of matrix multiplication, but we almost always just use the same one, and so it's almost just called matrix multiplication. So the most common thing we do with them is matrix multiplication. Matrix multiplication is a bit weird. So if I am multiplying two matrices together, okay, let's make this a little more boring. The definition of matrix multiplication. First off, matrix multiplication is traditionally done right to left, although it doesn't actually matter, but we traditionally do it right to left. It works the same both directions. But because I drew this poorly, I'm not going to draw it right to left because I don't have space. Okay, so first, the shape. Matrices can be any number of rows and columns. I'm going to get something out here. Okay, and it's going to have some number of rows and columns. And those rows and column numbers are going to be related to the input matrices, but not necessarily in an obvious way. The thing to remember about matrix multiplication is we're taking the dot product of a row and a column. Okay? We take the dot product of a row and a column, and we put the answer in the cell that would be the intersection of that row and column. So this was row and column one, so we'll put the answer in spot one. Okay? And because this is our definition, the number of rows we're going to get, the total number of rows, is going to be based on the number of rows. And the number of columns we're going to get is going to be based on the number of columns. Okay? And the other dimension, the width of the first matrix and the height of the second one, need to be the same as each other but have no bearing on the size of the output. Now, usually we won't care about this a great deal because mostly in graphics we just have 4x4 matrices and 1x4 matrices. And so we'll talk about those particular kinds in a moment. But this is the basic idea, okay, of how we multiply a matrix. And I suppose I could work through this, right? 1 times 1 plus 4 times 3 is 12, so that's 13, plus 2.1 times 7 is 14.7. 14.7 plus, what did I just say, 13 is 27.7? If I did that correctly, okay? And then we would just do that for every other combination of row and column we could have to get all of the cells of our matrix. Anybody want me to see me do another example of another cell or talk more about matrix multiplication? Okay. We multiply matrices by matrices. The other thing we do is we multiply them by vectors. And almost always, in graphics at least, the way we multiply a matrix by a vector is by treating this as a column vector and we put it second. Okay? There are rare cases where we do something else, but what does this look like? We have a matrix and we have a vector. And when I do the multiplication, You will notice that I am going to have this result, if we work through this, I'm going to keep this number of rows and this number of columns, which means I'm going to get back a vector. So I have a vector, matrix, and I get back a vector is the result. Okay? By, in essence, taking the dot product of this vector by each row of the matrix to get my new vector. We do this all the time in graphics. This is an operation that we do so many times that graphics cards have like several thousand copies of hardware devoted to doing it. Okay? It is really important in graphics. We do it all the time. But we don't have to do it. The computer does it in hardware thousands of times in parallel, millions of times a second. Hooray! We don't have to do the numbers. Okay? We just have to understand what the numbers do. What is it? What is the result of multiplying by a matrix? Okay? And here we're going to dive into a little bit of linear algebra that experience has taught me some people have sort of missed or didn't notice that we were talking about. So let's just talk briefly about what matrix times vector means. And to do this, we need to talk about a matrix as a linear operator. Any matrix can be thought of as being a system of linear equations, or as a linear operator. Turns out to be an equivalent thing. What do you mean by linear operator? Notice here, I can think of this matrix as being sort of a function from vector to vector in function notation. It takes one vector and produces another vector back. And it isn't all such functions. It is only ones that are linear. Linearity is mathematically defined with some rigor. There's multiple ways of thinking about it. One is simple. One is computable. But another definition of linearity is sort of this property that we can multiply it by something and get something back. Basically, what this means is a linear operator, it can squash, it can stretch, it can rotate, and it can flip. And that's what it can do. Any arbitrary combination of rotating, squashing, and flipping can be linear. Anything else can't. So, if I were to imagine, I don't know, a set of vectors representing a circle, maybe I have a bunch of vectors that I'm trying to use to be the locations of the tips of a clock or something like this. Okay. A linear operator, if I multiply all of those vectors by the same matrix, I can rotate it, squash it, stretch it, and flip it. But that's all I can do. Notably, that means I can't move it. It stays centered on the origin. Vectors are always centered on the origin. We'll actually change that with homogeneous vectors in class on Tuesday, but pure vectors always stay at the origin. They don't move. They can just squash or stretch and spin around. So I could get like along the ellipse here. That would be possible, okay? By sort of squashing and stretching, and I could spin that around, but I can't get something that isn't an ellipse, because when you squash a circle, you get an ellipse. I can't get something that isn't centered in the origin because I don't have a move here. These are the only things it can do. And so we use matrices a lot to do these operations, and we'll see a magical trick we will use to let them also move things around in class on Tuesday. But we're really sort of playing fast and loose with the definition of geometry when we do that. Matrices. Questions about matrices or vectors? Okay, I need to talk just briefly about one other use of matrices. In algebra, you learned about linear systems of equations, like 2x plus 3y equals 11, and negative 2x plus 18y equals 3. And you were said, what is x and y? Right? And you had to solve these problems until you didn't understand why anymore, until they were just a thing you did, and you forgot that they actually had use, and then they gave you word problems, which just seemed like ways of hiding the truth, right? Anyway. These turn out to be important for various things we do in some advanced graphics. These won't show up mostly in their early graphics, but we sometimes need to think about these. And these can be represented as matrices. This problem, you notice, has a grid of numbers. 2, negative 2, 3, and 18. That is then being dotted or multiplied with a vector, x and y. There's an equal sign, and on the other side, I have a vector. Okay? This is a just, if you line up things, this is a just a rewriting. It's moving symbols. I have done no work besides moving symbols. Okay? And this is entirely mathematically equivalent. So when we think about a linear system of equations, that is a linear operator times variables equals equals a vector. These are really, really important in computing. They're important in all kinds of numerical computation. They'll be important in a lot of simulation. We'll see a little bit of this in graphics, particularly when we talk about fluid simulations, a few other things as well. So what do we have to do if we want to solve this problem? We could do all the substitution and elimination you learned about in grade school, but we don't have to do that. There is a thing called a matrix inverse. Okay? The matrix inverse of any given matrix, often written, if I have some matrix M, then its inverse is M to the negative 1th power. This is actually slightly misleading. There is a notion of matrix powers that we're not going to go into particularly. It's a little bit complicated to define. But we typically write the inverse this way. And there is a definition that M times M inverse equals this thing we call the identity matrix. The identity matrix is something, if you multiply it by something, nothing changes. It is the one of matrices. Okay? If we think about what we need to have nothing change. Okay, I have some matrix, I'm multiplying it by x, y, z, and I need to get back x, y, z. Okay, well, this value here is taken by taking this thing and multiplying it by this row. I needed to keep x and lose the others. And this one was created by multiplying this by this row. I need to keep y and lose the others. And this one, by multiplying this by this row, I need to keep z and lose the others. And so the identity matrix has ones on what we call the principal or main diagonal, and zeros everywhere else. And it doesn't move anything. It leaves the world the same. It doesn't squash, doesn't stretch, doesn't rotate, doesn't flip. Okay? And every non-singular matrix, which is sort of like saying every number other than zero has a multiplicative inverse. It's a similar idea for matrices. If it doesn't squash something completely flat, then we can unsquash it. Okay? If it squashes it completely flat, we don't. But as long as it doesn't squash anything completely flat, then it has an inverse. And that inverse will undo its work. So if I have this equation, matrix A times the x vector equals the b vector, then I can solve for x by just saying that the x vector is, I just multiply both sides by the A inverse. It's worth noting, matrix multiplication is not commutative. If I multiply on the left on one side, I have to multiply on the left on the other side. I can't swap back and forth left and right. These two things turn into the identity matrix, which does no work. Right? So that doesn't matter. And then I just have A inverse B. Okay? This process of taking a linear equation and finding out what the variable that makes it work is really important in a lot of computing, in a lot of numerical computation, simulation, and graphics. This way of doing it is inefficient. Most of the time, this is not the best way of doing it. And so there are fancy libraries that look at the matrix and say, ooh, I noticed this matrix has special properties. I can solve it faster. And we could spend multiple semesters learning about those algorithms. There's a lot of them, and there's a lot of interesting things to say about them. But we don't need to because other people wrote the code. How do you solve a linear system of equation? You find some linear system of equation solver. You find out whatever it wants to know, and you give it that. Okay? Most of them work more efficiently if most of the A is full of zeros, but that's actually the common case for large matrices. And it will tell you what's going on. Theoretically, it's using these matrices. Practically, it's usually not. Questions about matrix inverses, linear systems, and equations?
So the meaning of the determinant of a matrix being zero is that it squashes things completely flat.
Yeah, if the determinant, so there's a way you can multiply the terms inside to find out if it's going to squash something flat in some direction. And the determinant is one of those. Yep. There are lots of others as well. Probably a more useful one is usually the singular value decomposition, but we don't use that very often because, I don't know, they're complicated to compute, I guess. Just sort of as an enrichment topic we won't actually need in this class, but since we're talking about matrices. So if I have like a sphere and I put it through some matrix, it can squash, stretch, and rotate. Okay? It might squash into a pancake. Okay? So it might become flat in one direction but not another. But it might also squash into a stretched pancake. So here's a question. I know I can't get back its original volume, but can I at least turn it, instead of an ellipse, can I make it into a circle? Can I undo as much as is undoable? And there is this thing called the pseudo-inverse, traditionally written with a plus sign, that does just that. It undoes as much as can be undone. Okay? This is actually really important in some areas of computation. It's not important in graphics. I just mention it for your information. In theory, I am told our linear algebra classes teach this. In practice, I am unconvinced. Have any of you seen the pseudo-inverse before? Okay, three or four of you. So yeah. Anyway, there's all kinds of cool things you can do with these and different ways of computing them. And there's different pseudo-inverses, actually. But anyway. That is mostly just a, this is an odd thing to talk about. All right. I feel like we have said enough about matrices and vectors and linear systems of equation. Anyway, let me say any more about any of those before we use them more in class. Okay. We now have derivatives, integrals, and spherical integrals. When I was a kid, I heard about calculus. And I thought, that's a cool word. I don't know what it means. So one day I asked my dad, what's calculus? And he said, it's sort of advanced math. And I said, ooh, that sounds scary. And then I learned it and I realized, oh, this is really boring. Okay, you may have had a different experience, but I think there's a mystique to calculus. And that's unfortunate because it's really boring. It's very useful, but it's really boring. There are basically two ideas in calculus we need to worry about. There's a third important, I guess there's two other important ideas. There's limits and infinite series. But derivatives are a really important idea in calculus. It's not as important as some others for us. Integrals will matter more when we get to ray tracing, but derivatives are a reasonable base. All a derivative is a graph. If we think about it as a graph, it's a graph of slopes. Okay? Or it is, we can also think about it as f of x plus a minus f of x divided by a. This is actually the definition of slope. Where are you? A little bit farther down compared to where you are here, divided by how far away that is. Let's see this. Okay, if I draw something, if I know this is x, and this is f of x, and this is x plus a, and this is f of x plus a, then the difference between these divided by that distance is the slope. That's what we mean by slope. Bigger numbers are steeper. Negative numbers slope to the right. Okay, but it's this for very small a. What do we mean by very small? Calculus tells you we mean zero. This is, I don't know. Depending on your version of infinitesimals, you may or may not agree with it being zero, and some people just never get back get away from the idea that calculus pretends to be about numbers that don't exist. Because if you divide by zero, there's no answer, right? Anyway, calculus tries to deal with that. We don't need to pay attention. It's just trying to tell us the slope. So if we were to graph the slope at every point, Okay, here I am, let's say I'm horizontal here, and then I start moving up. And I get sort of the biggest slope I will get there, and then the slope starts to drop off, and I'm level back down here. Okay, level there, back down to zero slope. And then I start going quite sharply downhill. And then I level off again for there. And then I'm going slightly uphill, and then I level off. Okay, and so you end up with some curve. And often derivatives are taught based on their curves, and these curves are so not important. Okay, the reason we care about derivatives is not because of this formal definition. It's because of what it means about motion. Okay, let's think about motion. Motion means your position is a function of time. If your position is a function of time, then what is your speed? Your speed is also a function of time. And it's a different function. Okay? If my speed is constant, my position is changing. And the bigger my speed is, the faster my position is changing. And if my speed is zero, my position isn't changing. And it turns out that speed is the derivative of position. Okay? Speed matters for animation. We want things to move. We need to know how fast they're moving, and we need to know where they are. So we need to get back and forth between speed and position by taking derivatives and antiderivatives, which are called integrals, to move back and forth between speed and position. Okay? What then is the derivative of speed? So speed is how quickly we are changing position. What do we call how quickly we are changing speed? Acceleration. Okay? And then we have the next question. What is the derivative of acceleration?
Jerk.
Please don't insult me. But this is called the jerk force, which is a bad name because it's not a force. But a sudden change in acceleration gives you the sense of the world jerking about a bit. Okay? This is what happens at the very end of putting on the brakes in your car as we switch from kinetic friction to static friction, and suddenly there's that little jerk as your acceleration, your deceleration goes from non-zero to zero suddenly. And, right? And you can feel it. You can see it in the cars in front of you and so on. Okay? We care about these only a little in most of graphics. Sometimes these will matter a lot. Most of what we're going to do, we'll get between these in a fairly kludgy way. Okay? We will just multiply speed by time to get position. And it will work out pretty well. But sometimes we'll need to do other fancier things, and so occasionally we'll need to come back to these concepts. Again, we almost never need to compute these. Sometimes we actually do have to push through derivative work by hand to figure out where we're going. But that's not a particularly common case. Questions about derivatives? Okay. Integrals are the opposite of derivatives, and that's cool, but so not what we care about integrals primarily for. Okay. An integral equals a sum of everything, which is a horrible thing to say. Okay? I really spent some time trying to figure out we'll come back to the graphics definition of integrals later, but the important thing to understand about integrals is that they tell you everything that came in. Let's think about this. Let's suppose I have a big vat. Okay, I have a vat, and I am pouring in water. So I have some water pouring into my vat. Okay, and so I can control the spigot. I can control how fast the water moves into my vat. And I want to know how full is the vat. Okay? Now, one way of measuring how full the vat is every so often I would measure the flow, and I would just assume it continued, and I'd add them all up. So I could say, okay, in each minute, how much was the flow? And I can say, in minute one, we had 2 gallons per minute. And in minute two, we had 1 gallon per minute. And in minute 3, we had back to 2 gallons per minute. And in minute 4, it was off completely. In minute 5, it was off completely. In minute 6, it was 8 gallons per minute. How much liquid is inside the tank? This is not a rhetorical question. If you care about what's going on, if you're disengaging, that's fine, right? You're welcome to sit here. But if you care about what's going on, how many gallons of liquid are in the tank if this is how it's been flowing?
13.
How did you get 13?
Add up the flows.
You add up the flows. Okay. But how many times should I have measured flow? I mean, maybe the flow varies a lot in a minute. Maybe it comes in like gusts, and I measured it and like it's really just the same all the time, but if I catch it the wrong time, I see 0, and the right time, I see 8. So maybe I need to measure it in smaller things than minutes. So maybe instead of chopping into minutes, I'm going to chop it into seconds. Okay, so I'm going to try to get 60 different seconds for each of these. So I'm going to have 60 times as many things to add up. They're going to be a 60th as large on average, or I'm going to divide them by the size interval I used. So you're going to add up all of the times it's ever been flowing. But seconds still might not be enough if we have like little shock waves going through the water. So maybe I need microseconds, and eventually we say, okay, we're good enough. This adding it up in tiny little steps is an integral. Okay? Adding up all of the possible things that matter about the world is an integral. This is what we call a linear integral, or a single dimensional integral. There's one kind of flow. But usually in graphics, we care about a very different kind of integral. Okay, let's consider, here is some object. And here is a light bulb. And here is the sun. And here is a white sheet of paper. All of these are emitting photons. How do I know what color this is? And the answer is, I figure out how much light is coming from there, and 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 how much light is coming from there, for all directions. And I add them all up. This is an integral. Okay? We'll talk more about how to design and deal with this integral later on. But when we use integrals in computing, it's almost always to deal with, it's coming from everywhere, how do I add it all up? And in calculus, you learn integrals pretty quickly, and then you spend, I don't know, multiple semesters learning how to solve them. The reason you spend multiple semesters learning how to solve them is most real integrals can't be solved. They have no closed form solution. And the real world has a lot of real integrals, so we never actually solve integrals. We just estimate them. And how do we estimate them? Okay, let's go back to our flow. Let's say this is flow, and this is time. And our flow is rising and falling over time, okay? And I want to know how much liquid made it into the tank. That little measure and add really just means I'm going to pretend like I have little rectangles. And I'm going to measure occasionally and add up what I measured, okay? Let's just take the sum of all of those rectangles. How wide they are is the time it took to flow. How tall they are is the rate of flow. I multiply those together to get the area of the rectangle. That tells me how much liquid I have. So the total liquid I have is the area underneath this curve. Okay? We almost never do this, though. This is really tedious. To say, I want to know how bright this pixel is, so I'm going to look in little spaces everywhere I could look to see what the lights are. We're not going to do that either. Instead, we use something called important sampling. Have any of you learned important sampling that have taken calculus? Okay, then clearly this is something I should come back to when it is not the math review day. We will do fancy magic to find this very efficiently by measuring only 3 or 4 times. We will talk about how later. All right. But the concept is just we want to find out how much got in by adding up everything from everywhere. And that is the list of topics I had. Questions about any of this? Yes?
Just a real quick question about important sampling. Is that related to like Nyquist sampling at all?
No. So Nyquist sampling, I'm not an expert in Nyquist, but I believe that's about periodicity.
Yeah, it's about periodicity.
Yep. And this is not about periodicity, it's about intensity. Yeah?
What about spherical?
So what do I mean by spherical integral? I mean I want to integrate over the sphere. I want to add up all portions of a hemisphere, as opposed to all points in time. So that's what we are talking, right? So when we add up everything, we have to add up everything in some subset because everything is weirdly defined. And so often in integration and in graphics, what it means is we need to add up all of the little pieces on a sphere, what all of them would do for us, or usually a hemisphere in practice. We'll talk some more about that because it's evident that spherical integrals and important sampling is not something you've all learned. Any other questions?
Is like random sampling a valid technique?
Yeah. Okay, how likely is it to work? Let's think about liquid flowing into a tank. Where is my liquid flowing into a tank? If instead of measuring once a minute, I just picked 5 random times and measured, would that be better, worse, or the same as what I'm doing?
Worse.
How do you know?
Well, here you're actually summing everything constant.
Well, am I? I have 6 measures.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know what this looked like, right? Let's just guess. I mean, it could be, okay, let's say that this was 0 and I'm going to go out. So we were at 1, and then we were at 2, and then we were at 3, and then we were at, sorry, that's the wrong side. We were at 2. And then we were at 1, and then we were at 2, and then we were at 0, and it stayed at 0 for a while, and then we were way up at 8. Right? This might be what the flow looked like over time. But it doesn't have to be what the flow looked like over time. The flow could have looked like this.
Yeah.
Right? And I just happened to catch it when it had certain values. If that's what it looked like, does it matter when I sampled? Not a great deal, right? And so sometimes you say, I don't know what it's doing, so I'm just going to pick at random. It's as good as anything else. And if we do know what it's doing, we try to be cleverer about where we sample. Another way of thinking about this, if I want to know how much water goes through your bathroom sink, okay, but I only want to take, 50 samples. In sampling every 30 minutes, my best way of sampling. When should I sample the flow in your sink? Probably when you're in the bathroom, right? So I don't want a uniform random distribution because you're probably not in the bathroom at equal times all day long. I want to sample when it's important to sample, which is when you are running the faucet. This is where important sampling comes from. We will talk much more about how we figure that out with light later on, right? But this is the idea. If I'm just going to add up a few things, I want to get the ones that matter. And the ones that matter are the ones that are contributing something to the answer. Other questions? Anything more I can say about math?